Welcome to episode 141 of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts Andrew, David, and Jen. This week we read The Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller. And now, the cast begins.
Okay, everybody, welcome to a television-narrated episode of the Atomic Pirate Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with Jen.
Hey!
And David.
What up?
This week, we read Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller. This bad boy's from 1986, and it's issues 1-4 of The Dark Knight. And the artist is not in the notes again this week.
That would be Klaus Janson. Janson.
And art by Klaus Janson. Janson or Janson? Janson. That guy.
Yep. Wow.
Yep. But, to be fair, we will talk about the art later, and I should have pronounced his name better because I like it quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, what do we think about this this comic on the whole? Because we just finished, this is our Morrison versus Miller arc, and we're going to go with the character Batman. Both of them are quite famous for writing. And we just finished our two episodes of Morrison. This is our first piece of Miller in the Morrison versus Miller thing. So what do you guys think of Frank Miller?
I like this a lot. I think it's a very cool Batman story. And I like the way it paints the DC universe. It reminded me of, it has like, what am I trying to say? It reminds me a little bit of Watchmen in some ways.
I can see that.
But I don't feel like it was like trying to capitalize on Watchmen or anything like that. Because those came out in the same year. I don't remember exactly what year Watchmen came out.
86 is pretty close. I feel like they were pretty close.
Yeah. And I think this kind of... I've never really read much Silver Age Batman, but I know that around the time of the Adam West TV series, Batman was kind of a goofy character. Yeah. And I know that the show kind of revived interest in Batman. Like, I don't think the comics weren't doing well when that show came out. And I think so Batman kind of mirrored that. Mirrored the show to a certain degree. And this is like a different take on... This is a very serious take on Batman. I don't want to use the word gritty because I feel like that has a negative connotation. To me, in my mind, that has a negative connotation. I think it tries to be realistic a little bit.
Yeah.
As realistic as you can be in a comic book.
Yeah, and I think realistic is a good word, especially thinking about Batman's age in this. How, like, compare this to, say, Court of Owls, where, yeah, he gets beat up, but at the end of the day, he's still more or less an invincible hero. He should have been dead 10 times over in that. And in this, he gets beat up too, but he gets beat up in a way that maybe it's a combination of narrator, art, writing, that kind of thing that makes me think he really is moving slower. Like, the Joker couldn't have gotten these hits in on him. These kid punks would have never stood a chance in his prime, but he's fucking, what, 55, I think he was?
Yeah.
When at the funeral they said he was 55, like, come on, that's gonna be, you're gonna be slower than those kids. No matter how trained of a fighter you are, you're gonna be slower.
And he calls it out multiple times in his narration narration or his exposition, you know?
Yeah. So what about you, Jen? What did you think of this one?
I really enjoyed it, and I feel... It's like David says, it's not gritty, but it's certainly serious, and it was really interesting to watch Batman contemplate his own fragility, because that really isn't something we see. I think a common Batman plot is Batman is mentally fragile, but oh look, it turns out he's not. Mm-hmm. And in this, you know, he's actually like really mentally sound, even though early on we see him fighting these inner demons trying to not become Batman again. But it turns out to be the right thing for him. And mm-hmm. It's this very interesting tension of the desire to do something and your own capabilities and where those two intersect and where they disagree. And I thought just that exploration made this comic really enjoyable, because that's a fun thing to see with superheroes. It's it adds tension, even if we know the hero is going to triumph at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to point out, too, like, at the beginning, we see him in conflict, and we see him as Bruce Wayne. And then as soon as he makes that decision, I don't think we see much of Bruce Wayne at all, ever after that.
No, actually.
Because I think at the beginning, you're right, he's troubled, and he's fighting that mental battle to stay Bruce. And it's wrecking him. I mean, he's turning to alcohol the way he never would have before. And then when he finally falls into that decision, we never see him take a drink again. We never see him fall into those problems. He doesn't ever argue with himself as he's walking down the street. He's suddenly emotionally and psychologically very sure of himself. His body's not there anymore. Now that he's finally figured out what he really wants, it's too late.
I think there's also a really good sense of his limitations, and they show that. Well, Miller repeats this line over and over, and Batman keeps saying, "Lucky old man," like just to himself, yeah. Like reminding himself that he's not in his prime and he is mortal. And I don't know, like I didn't have any doubt throughout this comic that he would succeed, because
yeah.
You don't, like, Batman just doesn't fail. It's completely impossible. But you know, it was really nice to see him acknowledge that, because it made you feel like he had doubts.
That's true. So we're talking about Batman and how he's aging in this, but I think it's interesting too to look at how, who is it? I think it's Selina Kyle mentions that everybody else has changed too, and that it's not just him who's come back different, but maybe in fact he's the only one who came back the same. And she tries to warn him, like, the Joker is different. Two-Face is different. Like, these people come back, yeah, and they're the same villains, but they're not the same.
Even Superman talks about that, too.
Yeah. And so it's, I mean, you see it with Selina Kyle, and Joker says it. And what does Joker say? The years have not been kind to you?
Yeah.
And that's true. I mean, she's not anywhere near the person she was before. And look at her day job now. Before, what was her cover before? I think she was just an heiress. And now she's an escort service. She's like a pimp. You know, and it's interesting to see the way that these villains change in the absence of Batman. You know, I mean, we get some that rehabilitate, right? Like Harvey Dent kind of rehabilitates in this. But
the doctor decides that he's been rehabilitated.
Yeah,
and it turns out that's definitely not the case.
They do the surgery, and yeah, no, he's messed up. But maybe that's interesting though, because that happens not very long after Bruce Wayne decides that he is Batman. He's given up on the idea of Bruce Wayne. It's not working for him. It's destroying him. So he completely throws himself into being Batman, even more than before. He doesn't even bother with a cover half the time, it seems like, in this. And sort of Two-Face does the same thing, doesn't he? He gets out and he's like, my face is whole. There's no dichotomy to his life anymore. He's a whole face. There's no split, but it's all ruined. It might be pretty on the cover, but he's actually all ruined.
Yeah, and I mean, there's that scene at the end of the first issue where he's asking Batman to look at him, and, you know, Batman sees him for what he truly is, and I don't know, like, I actually was a little weirded out by that change, just because, I guess not weirded out, I was depressed by it, because Harvey Dent was always really torn, and it seems like in the time he was supposed to be rehabilitated, he actually just really fully succumbed to his inner darkness, and that was just a sad moment, I thought.
Well, it fits in the theme of this book. I mean, so many of the changes are sad. I mean, maybe we're rolling through the villains a bit, but Joker, to me, is a really interesting change. Not just in how he ends up as a villain, but also what he's like when Batman's gone. right? Because I get the sense from reading this that he was basically catatonic.
Yeah, well, and... Oh, go on.
I was going to say, a recurring theme in Batman is about how Joker can't exist without Batman. They matter to one another on a very deep level.
Yeah.
And this shows you the consequences of when one is removed. And so, like you said, Joker goes catatonic, and then when he realizes Batman comes out, he snaps out of it, and it's almost like he's making up for lost time, trying to do the things that the stuff that he's doing.
Yeah, and I gotta say, that scene where, like, the television is talking about how Batman's back, and there's those initial reports, and then they show you Joker, and that smile just kind of creeps on a half of his face, and then the other half, and it's this nice slow buildup of him coming out of it. That was fucking awesome. That, like, scene was so well drawn. I love that. But for me, that the idea that he was in a catatonic state, I mean, yeah, they're tied together in a lot of ways, but it's sort of like his existence is completely consumed now with Batman. And you get that constant question, like, I don't even remember where I first heard this. I couldn't accredit it to anybody, but there's this idea that, like, would the villains exist if the heroes didn't? Isn't it kind of like an arms race? I think it's even comes up in the Dark Knight movies too. Like, we get bullets, they get vests. We get armor-piercing vests, they get this, you know? And it's just this escalation until eventually you get to fucking crazy wacko sociopaths, right? And that's the reaction to somebody like Batman. So, if there's no Batman, what happens to these villains? Do they even have an existence that's necessary? Do they have anything they can possibly contribute to society? And for Joker, it's obviously a no here, but then that kind of creates this other moral implication. Like, while Batman was off duty, Joker was catatonic. Batman comes back and all of those people in that theater are dead because Joker's back too, because Batman came back. Right? And so I think Bruce rationalizes it to himself, saying that the world still sucks and the city still needs me and I never should have retired. But in a part, aren't some of those lives that Joker takes here on him?
Definitely. I mean, that's the way that the story presents it, right?
And they have actually a really good discussion. I mean, the news segments do get really excessive in this, but some of them contain that argument really well, especially when we see, like, the point-counterpoint thing with Lana Lang.
Yes.
And whoever that guy is, talking about whether there is value to having Batman or if he's an overall negative on Gotham. And they never resolve that ever, which I think is actually nice, just because it is a valuable question to ask. And they even say, like, oh, you know, the crime statistics went down when he came back, and then pseudo-psychiatrist?
Yes.
God, he was full of shit. But I think his underlying argument, you know, basically that a violent society produces violent people, mm-hmm. is to a degree correct, because, you know, scaring people... We have a very punitive justice system, and, Gotham does. And it's obviously not working, because there's still gangs taking over the city. The mutants mm-hmm. are declaring war. It's, like, super extreme for crime. And obviously, this punitive system of punishing villains and bad guys isn't working. But at the same time, we see Batman try to produce, Bruce Wayne try to produce change in Harvey Dent by, you know, funding his therapy, but that doesn't change anything either. So there's a tension between rehabilitation of quote-unquote evil and, you know, just locking these people up and throwing away the key, and it's never really resolved which is better.
Yeah, and we get it not just on the Batman level. We get it on the street level, too. Like,
yeah,
how
certainly.
These changes happen with the way, okay, great, Batman goes in and takes out the mutants, hunky-dory, right? Except then they splinter off into groups like the Nixons, and maybe even worse, the Sons of Batman. Right?
Well,
like,
and Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, they go out there and they do these things, but they're still the same terrible, violent people they were before. They've just changed their targets.
Yeah, and they say, you know, we're doing Batman's work, but killing random people, cutting off their hands, it's... Batman wouldn't do that. Yeah. And it's for petty stuff, too, like stealing a slice of pizza or something.
Yeah, I think the cut-off hands was for shoplifting. And it was, like, for a magazine and a little bit of food.
I was going to say, we see it... We see that level of violence, too, in the regular people. There's a whole section at the end after the plane crashes in Gotham.
Yeah.
Where it's little news interviews with different people, and it's the... The guy with the neck brace and the
neck
priest.
Neck brace and the glasses and the, yeah.
And how the guy said rationalized all his violent activities because everyone else was doing it kind of thing, or because Batman was the reason people were acting out. And it's these, and the, even the priest kind of shows when he describes the, he was scared of the guy with the boombox. But it turned out to be this, like, businessman in the suit who was the real violent person. You know, he's the one who fought for the gun and all that stuff, so...
And that kid with the boombox is the one who stayed and helped people.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that that guy with the glasses, we saw him before, talking about, what was it? No, he pushed the guy in front of the subway train.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like this violence and this aggressiveness through rationalization. You know, like, he's in the business suit, and he says things much more intelligently than the mutants do. But it's just his way of rationalizing his actions that are, and his thoughts that are just as aggressive as theirs. He's really no different. He sounds more educated, he's able to say things better, and perhaps he can talk his way out of some of the things that he does. And maybe he convinces himself of those same things too, but... He's just as violent and just as aggressive, but because he doesn't look like them, because he's not as outwardly aggressive and speaks the way they speak, it's okay. We buy his rationalizations. Well, we don't, but, you know, they do, and, you know.
He actually came off as more evil to me than the mutants, and I thought that was interesting because... I kind of felt like the mutants are just kind of these punk kids who are very directionless. You know, they lose their leader and they're like, what now? But this guy keeps... He does something the mutants never do. He disguises what he's doing as right. And I think for that reason, we're supposed to really despise him. But at the same time, the question is asked of Batman... You know, you're doing these bad things, you're hurting people, and you're saying what I'm doing is right, but are you right?
I mean, look at the list of charges that the new commissioner brings up against him, right? I mean, they're all true, but that list is insane. She's like, immediately at that press conference, has like 5 or 6 major crimes that they can get him for. And then they add child endangerment to it later. Which I love.
And then eventually murder after they find...
After they find Joker.
Yeah. But I don't know. And it's so weird, too, because that guy who pushes the hobo off the train platform, maybe it's because he doesn't have a cause and he's just looking out for number one, right? But he seems so evil and Batman seems so good. Like, I never doubt that Batman's doing the right thing, even with the criminal charges, even seeing him bash in people's faces. I look at Batman, and I really do feel like he's a hero. He's someone who's trying really hard to help people and help his city.
Yes. And the other group I want to talk about, speaking of helping your city, are the two commissioners in here and the police force. The police are, you know, they're there. They're not really characters. They're just kind of around. But I want to talk about the two commissioners. I think it's awesome that Jim Gordon never retired, because Jim Gordon doesn't retire. He was forced into retirement. Batman quit, but Jim stayed on the job. I think that's friggin' awesome, because that's exactly what he would do. And then I also like he tries to give her advice. He tries. I don't envy you. Be patient. Weather the storm. You know, like, he basically says 10 ways to Sunday without saying it out loud. keep your head down and do your job. And instead, she comes right out of the gate, and with this arrest warrant for Batman, she calls in all the troops, she sets up a trap for him, all this kind of stuff. But by the end of the comic, she's saying no comment to the cameras the exact same way that Jim was.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Didn't take long for you to learn, did it?
But did you like
her? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, did you like her?
You know, I think I did.
Yeah, I think she... You know, we didn't see her for a long period of time in the comic. Well, basically the second half. But she definitely grows to understand how Batman can be beneficial.
Yeah. And I think I grew to like her the same way you did, David, and the same way she grew into it, because she's not fanatical about Batman, you know? She just doesn't understand the relationship that Jim and Batman have.
Yeah, I think she, you know, she is trying to catch Batman because he is breaking the law.
He is.
In a very public way. But it's not like a witch hunt.
Yeah, and nothing she says about him is wrong. When she goes in and her and Jim have that conversation, you know, and Jim's like, I'm surprised they made a good decision. You're incredibly qualified for this. This was a great call. You're going to be a wonderful commissioner. He says all of those things. And when they're having that discussion, she says all the reasons why she firmly and adamantly believes that they need to go out there and catch Batman. And nothing she says when she does that do I disagree with.
Yeah.
It's all totally rational. She's not fanatical at all. I think she just doesn't understand how Batman works necessarily. Because I think she gets it when, what is it, when Batman calls her over the radio and says that the mayor is going to die tonight and I don't have time to go save him.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's kind of like, it's kind of the underhanded way of saying, if I weren't here, not only would you not have known that, but you might not have gotten either one of them, and you would be stuck with that choice.
Hmm. That is actually really true. Hmm. You know, I gotta say, like, at first I thought she was going to be that awful trope where they take good guy Jim Gordon and then replace him with this awful woman who hates Batman, is, you know, just never gets it. But I will say, the moment that she told Jim Gordon that he was her hero, I started to warm up to her, because I thought, someone who respects Jim Gordon like that and has a good respect for what he did in office as commissioner,
mm-hmm,
can't be all bad. And that proved to be true. So I liked that Miller didn't just do the normal, like, here's your archetype type thing.
Even though I think that's what Jim was expecting, too.
Yeah.
Because
he seemed surprised.
Didn't he at first? Somebody made a comment about her being a woman. And I think it might have been Jim. Because I remember I was a little taken aback by that. I was like, really, buddy? You've been a cop for how long? You don't respect female officers of the law?
It seemed too. Like, that seemed like a weird, flippant comment. And it felt out of place, but the thing that made me actually believe that he had doubts about her was the guy who picked her. Gallagher, yeah, or whatever? Was that his name?
Whatever office. Yeah.
The public relations dude. And,
yeah, that's who it was.
You know, it just, I could see why Jim Gordon wouldn't trust someone who was chosen by the guy he's been kind of fighting in the force. And they showed that really clearly in the beginning, too, where he is really mad about a PR leak, and he just, like, in one sentence is explained that he and Gallagher have not gotten along for a very long time.
And you kind of get the sense that Gallagher's running the show and not the mayor. And the mayor's actually a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of got that. So, I mean, the only character we haven't talked about yet is Robin. Right? Oh, old Alfred, too, but we'll get to him later, maybe. Robin, what did you guys think of this Robin that's not in canon, I think, anywhere else in comics? I think this is the only time she shows up.
She was cool. I have a good respect for any sidekick who, you know, basically dresses up and forces a hero to, you know, take them under their wing. She showed a lot of bravery and wherewithal, and it seemed a little abrupt that this random high school girl would be able to do all the Robin stuff, whereas all the other Robins, there was some background in their life that made it possible. You know, like being an acrobat or being Batman's son. Those things help.
Well, I think Carrie Kelly reminded me of Tim Drake, because Tim Drake basically became Robin because he figured out who Batman and Nightwing were.
Yeah.
He didn't have... I don't think he had a background in the same way that, you know, Dick Grayson did. And neither did Jason Todd, really, either, right?
I don't think so. Or Barbara Gordon. She reminds me a lot of Barbara Gordon.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of like Barbara Gordon.
Actually, I will argue that Barbara Gordon and Tim Drake both have, like, a strong background in computer stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and Tim Drake was his detective, and, like you said, the computer stuff definitely lended themselves to fitting into Batman's.
Yeah, it, like, adds something that Batman has, but, like, isn't as strong as... Because Batman is smart, and he can use computers really well, but... We mostly see him doing the physical aspect, so it makes sense to have someone else do the mental part. But she just seemed like a normal teenage girl, and I think the stuff where she was able to reprogram his helicopter was supposed to show us that she had that, like, kind of savviness about her, but at the same time, this is the 80s, so I don't know what I'm supposed to expect from characters and technology.
Well, and Batman says a couple times that she's really good with computers and that she's smart. And early on, she's talking about how she intentionally failed the grades and then how she would be fine because she was confident that she was so smart in this other, I think it was chemistry area or whatever. But we get that scene when she gets jumped at the arcade They're talking about her intelligence and all that kind of thing. Which is really, I like that there was that scene to establish why she was even inspired at all. And not just like, oh, hey, I'm a really big fan. No, like, he saved my life. He's back. Oh, my God, he's real.
Yeah.
I was like 3 when he quit. Oh my God, he's real. Oh my God, oh my God. I'm going to go spend 2 weeks worth of, what the hell's the word?
Allowance.
I was going to say kids don't get paychecks. like 2 weeks of her allowance on a costume. I thought that was really cool. The other thing that kind of got me about her is, like, how quickly Batman trusted her. Like, it was like, oh, you saved my life. My name is Bruce Wayne.
So, I actually have a thing about that. And in the notes, you know, you say that and then I say, like, yeah, in a creepy pedophile way. And by that, okay, so I don't actually see anything sexual about this, even when it gets, like, kind of weird when she, like, jumps and hugs him when he's all naked. What struck me about this is... Every other time Batman has taken a young person under his wing, it feels fairly natural, like they're an outcast or, you know, they don't have parents or they have these abilities that just make it a good fit. And yes, she is smart and her parents are losers who don't, like, even remember she's there half the time. But there was something very offsetting about their relationship where I looked at it and said, this is a completely inappropriate relationship for a man of his age to be having with a girl of her age. And I never did that for Dick Grayson or Jason Todd or Tim Drake. Like, I was always like, okay, that sounds cool. But here, and it's not because she's a girl. That's the weird, I don't know. There's something about that immediate bond of trust and the way that he kind of took her in that felt off and slightly disturbing to me. And I can't explain what it is.
See, until you said it's not because she's a girl, I was going to bring up the fact that in the first issue of these four, people will tell Bruce, all you need is a woman. And I was thinking, like, maybe you could draw that connection where they tell him all you need is a woman and he's found a woman in his life, but she's fucking 13. But I didn't ever draw anything sexual to that, but I think... Maybe the weirdness you're feeling for this is the same kind of weirdness people had with the idea of Batman and Robin the first... I mean, there's the whole thing with, oh, Batman and Robin, gay, pedophilia. whatever, you know, that non-nerd culture likes to put on this duo. And I don't know why it would come up just for her, though. It's weird.
I think the reason Batman accepted her and included her in his like inner circle so quickly is because he wanted to fill that role that was missing in him, in his like life as Batman, I guess. And I think that the quickness of it is kind of strange, but I didn't, to me it wasn't any more inappropriate than any of the other Robins.
You know, when you said the quickness, that actually made me realize, after everything about Jason Todd and the uniform there, and Gordon mentions it, it struck me as really odd that Batman doesn't resist at all when she wants to be Robin after what happened with Jason. Maybe that's my problem. Mm. Maybe that's what makes it feel unnatural.
Yeah, because it's a complete like 180 from where we just saw him. Yeah. And we even get, and he gets, Alfred reminds him outright.
Yeah. Says, he dances around it, and then he has to come out and say it, yeah. And
he's like, did you forget what happened to Jason already? And so, I think maybe, I'm not trying to put thoughts into your head, Jen, but I think maybe the reason why it seems inappropriate is because the loss of Jason Todd is the reason he stopped being Batman. And he just completely, you know, he says he'll never forget what happened to Jason, but he so quickly fills that role with the first candidate, you know?
I know, right? It's not even like he took applications, did a couple interviews.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, I don't think you're putting thoughts into my head at all. I think you nailed it, because it does feel really wrong that if something so monumental like this makes you change everything about who you are and no longer be Batman. Because, you know, like, as we saw earlier, Batman is him. Bruce Wayne is the container for Batman. He's just like a shell for Batman. Why suddenly ignore the thing that was so big that it made you give up everything? Mm-hmm.
So I had a problem with Robin getting introduced so quickly. But the scene that got me to be okay with it was when they're like on the Bat Glider and he's talking about how lucky they are. And Batman's narrating and saying that Jim always used to say, all it will take is one stray bullet. And then all of a sudden that strap that's holding Robin in breaks and she starts to fall. And he grabs her and holds her close. And he says, she didn't even scream. She's not even crying. And there's this like little look on his face. And then he pulls her in tight and says, good soldier, good soldier. Like, I think even though he's this recluse, there's some part of him that not only wants to protect people and protect and hold maybe even kids the way that he didn't get as he was growing, that he didn't get that development. But there's something in him that wants to teach, that wants to train, that wants to pass on. There's something about him that wants to create this legacy, right? Because he would just... Because what gets me is that he says, good soldier. He doesn't say, good Robin. He doesn't say, good girl. He doesn't say, good anything else. He says, good soldier. And that's when it hits me. That's what he's training. He's training her to be a soldier. To be not necessarily a replacement in the future, but somebody who can continue this legacy that he spent so much time building and that he couldn't get away from. And that he sees this girl maybe needs. And that's when I was like, okay, now I understand why he accepted it. Because he's older and he knows he's out there on a limb. He knows he can't do it like this forever. That he will keep getting older and the kids will keep getting younger and the crazy people will stay young. Because there's young, crazy people coming up all the time and he's just going to age. So he knows he's going to die, and this legacy is passed on to Dick, but we never see Dick. you know? And I think that's a little telling, too. Something happened between them that created this falling out. And his legacy doesn't... His lineage of a superhero doesn't go through Dick anymore. It doesn't go through anything. It doesn't go through Dick. It doesn't go through Dick. It goes through Carrie Kelly now. Carrie Kelly, that's her name, right? Yeah. Carrie. It was Carrie something. I don't know.
And eventually the Sons of Batman, right?
Yes. Which makes... That scene sets up the ending so well. That good soldier scene. Because that's what he's doing at the end. He's creating an army of little Batman.
I think he realizes... He sees the way the world is going, and he... realizes that he can't do it alone, because I mean, we talk, you know, Superman kind of talks about the Justice League, saying how Diana returned to Themyscira and Hal is in space.
Yeah.
And so and Superman is no longer
he's
superhero.
He's a tool. Yeah.
And so and Batman recognizes that there's still a need for the brand of heroics that he dished out prior to retirement. And so now he's setting up a path to get back to that place. I mean, a lot of, you know, he takes in the Sons of Batman, the former mutants, to be his new, I guess, not sidekicks, but his soldiers. And they're just like Jason Todd. They're like street kids who were criminals, and now he's turning them into heroes. Because mm-hmm. That's Jason Todd was the same way, right? I mean, he Batman picked him because he was stealing the hubcaps off the Batmobile or whatever, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, we see similarities in other, in other heroes, or excuse me, in other Batman sidekicks. In the people he's recruiting and bringing into his cause. You know, Carrie Kelly has a Barbara Gordon, Tim Drake vibe to her. And these Sons of Batman have a Jason Todd vibe. At least that's how I view it, you know.
Yeah, I know, I'm right there with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about some things I didn't like about the comic. Is that okay? Because I think we've been spewing a little bit.
Sure.
How did you guys feel about the TV narration mechanic that happens here?
So, I liked it and I disliked it. I liked it because it did a good job of setting the tone of the world Batman was in. It's the state of Gotham and beyond. And so, and it was cool because it wasn't just Batman or one of the core cast members, telling it to us. We got, talking heads. That's exactly what we get, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And it was cool because... So this is going to sound weird. It was cool because I can't even resolve. I was going to say it doesn't interrupt the narrative, but at the same time it does.
It is the narrative.
Yeah. So it doesn't, at the beginning it doesn't cut into the Batman story. Frank Miller doesn't even try to weave it in. It's like, okay, here's the Batman, what's happening with Bruce Wayne, and then here's what's happening in the world. And then they kind of intersect at some points where somebody talks about Batman or somebody talks about Batman's conflict indirectly, but then later it becomes a bit of a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was a little too much of it, and so that was a little distracting. But overall, I thought it was a cool mechanic and way to tell the story without having Batman do all the telling.
You know, I agree with you like 80%. I love the way it set up the story, them talking about how hot it is and how it's driving people outside to the streets, and that's why people are feeling like shit and they're committing crime, and it's like, maybe it's because we're in the middle of a heat wave here where we live, and I entirely get how the heat just destroys people. And like, that stuff worked really good, and talking about like the point-counterpoint brings up so many interesting discussions about how Batman works. you know, and what his return is doing to the city of Gotham. That stuff works great, but then there's so many times that it just either unnecessarily intrudes or makes the pace and the narration so busy. There are pages that I turn to that could be four panels and instead are fucking 13.
Yeah, there were some points, especially towards the end, where I turned the page and it was like tons of this talking head type of thing, and I kind of was like, I have to get through this. I have to slog through this to get back to Batman.
Yes, it's great. Whatever. I don't even remember what her name was. Jane Valderrama, I'll go with.
I don't think that was it, but...
No, that's not it. That's the news reporter from Saints Row.
But, yeah, it got tiresome towards the end. I'll go with tiresome.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, in the beginning, I feel like it set up the story and it set up the discussion that the comic was trying to have really, really well. And instead of letting the story finish the discussion and let you come to a resolution, it kept having the discussion for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, instead of letting you see, this is what Batman's doing, this is the effect that he's having, I can see these changes in Gotham, this is the resolution that I am coming to with Batman. No, it just kept going. It's like, go away, let me think for myself for 5 minutes. But maybe that's kind of the point, is that in this world, people, including you, the reader, aren't allowed to think for yourself. Which brings me to my other kind of negative point with this comic is the tons of cynicism in this, especially about the future and the U.S. government and the state of the world. It's something that kind of bugs me in a lot of stuff I read, but I don't know. Does anybody else ever notice that when you read something and it's talking about the near future, always it was better in the past, it's shit now, and it's only going to get worse as the kids grow up?
I think this was super prevalent in 80s comics especially, because there was a general vibe that... I mean, notice in this, they keep saying Batman's a fascist. Yeah. And I think in 80s comics, there was this general social vibe of, we need to beware of fascism. We see it in V for Vendetta, most prominently, but it's there in Watchmen, too, you know?
Yeah.
Who's protecting us from fascist heroes, from people who want to control us. And I think... It's a cynicism that goes with the times, because I feel like we don't see this as much in, like, 90s comics. 90s comics almost feel like it's more about, at least the major conflicts seem to be more about, like, external threats, like aliens and stuff. But I think the 80s had a lot of social commentary to offer up in comics. I don't know, maybe I just haven't read enough 90s stuff.
Yeah, I think, maybe I am missing the boat on the fact that this is mid-80s. This is 2 years after 84, 3 years before 89. I might be missing that boat.
We get a lot of, like, you know, in the 80s, it was the heavy Cold War. I mean, we get the conflict Soviet with Russia, yeah. Soviets here. I mean, Reagan is the president. I mean, they don't come right out and say it, but it's definitely Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Definitely, like, it looks exactly like him. And keep in mind too, like, the 80s was kind of like when materialistic culture was at an all-time high, and it was all about your power tie and your fancy car and the, you know, the loft apartment you had in Manhattan. And it comes across, I think, in the religious doomsayers that we see in this comic. You know, the end is nigh. And there's just kind of a cynicism, like the guy who assaults the man with crutches, the beggar, and pushes him in front of a train. I think he's almost supposed to represent, like, this American psycho type of mindset of thinking, like, you know, they're out to get me. This is ultra competitive. I got to look out for myself and do whatever it takes to do that. So, I don't know. I felt like it was partially dark just because it was, like, Frank Miller. I also felt like the time that this comic was published had a lot to do with how it came across.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think I'm missing the historical criticism angle I could take on this in favor of my reading response criticism. And that, okay, let me break it down. When you see the president wearing the suit that's literally made of stars and stripes, whenever I see that, it really bugs me. Because it breaks down to the fact that the highest office a person can attain in this country is turned into a PR marketing symbol, right? That bugs me on a level of my patriotism, sure, but it also bugs me on the level of, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of fucking Upgrade and Idiocracy, right? Because if you're gonna do it, right, if you're gonna turn the president into just a PR symbol, then that's what he becomes. The president is just Upgrade, and it doesn't matter how smart you make him look, how smart you make him sound, how cynical you try or witty you try to be about it. Like, sometimes they'll have a Texan accent and they'll go that way, or sometimes it'll be Reagan and it'll go that way. However you try to spin it, if you turn the president into a walking PR symbol, a figurehead of what the government's supposed to be, if you turn him into that by dressing him up that way, he just becomes nothing more than Upgrade. Right? And it's like, it removes complexity from the situation. It'd be so much more complex of a story if that character had agency and the U.S. government had agency and it wasn't just a machine. And this man was the PR symbol of that machine. It feels so simple to me, and the simplicity only works in movies like Idiocracy, where they take it just to that extreme. So I think that's a criticism only I can give, in that probably I'm one of the few people who sees Ronald Reagan just like that and thinks of Upgrade. I think I'm pronouncing it right. How many Ys is there? Three?
Are you confusing Upgrade with the president?
Wait, Upgrade's not the president?
No, Upgrade's the pimp.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. What's the president's name? Oh, God. Beef Supreme.
No, Beef Supreme's the... It's,
God damn it.
Herbert... Camacho, Herbert Elizondo, Mountain Dew Camacho, or something
that's
like that.
Right. Yes.
President Camacho.
President Camacho. Yes. Okay, that guy.
Yeah, he has a vest on. That's the American flag.
Yes. Okay. That's the guy I meant to be talking about this entire time.
And Upgrade had two of whatever letter for a double dose of pimpin'.
That's right.
So I think it's two Ys.
Yes. So yeah,
Camacho. That's. Like, if you're going to make Reagan that, go the full Monty and turn it into an actual criticism and not just cynicism. But, like I say, that's... Since it's just my criticism, I don't know.
It was weird, too, because, like, it was clearly Reagan, but it didn't... You're right, it didn't necessarily feel, like, Reagan-esque. There was a part for me where I was just like, what? Where, right when... Reagan gets on the TV and he's like, "Hey, America, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that the Russians left. The bad news is we're about to get nuked." And he's just wearing this like radioactive protection suit and he looks so cheery about it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, whether or not you agree with Reagan's politics, I think that anyone who has seen footage of him I was too young to remember when he was president, really, just like very vaguely.
Yeah.
He would not have done that ever. So it felt like, as you said, not a critique, but just cynicism.
Yeah. Okay. My second to last negative point, and this is something I run into too often because I have a degree in psychology, is just the constant mockery of psychiatry as a practice. Like, why? Come on, really? Really? Because of repressed sexual energy? You had to go that way. This is the 80s. Freud had already been discounted. Nobody believed Freud in crap. I mean, you're putting ignorance on the page when you write shit like that. It just bugs me on a fundamental level. And then I'm going to end my bitch fest by saying, holy ellipses, Batman. There are so many ellipses in this comic. And that's just a fundamental writing pet peeve of mine. You don't need that many ellipses. That's not what they're there for.
Yeah, I think that's probably just a stylistic choice by Miller.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with it.
No, you don't have... You know, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying I think that's what you can... You can chalk it up to that.
Yeah.
It probably wasn't poor. I mean, okay, it is a poor way to use punctuation, but I don't think it was done accidentally. It was probably a conscious decision.
No, it definitely was. But all of that said, the writing, Frank Miller, man, he can pump out some beautiful lines. Like I was saying before, that good soldier one. Mm-hmm. I mean, that line sets up so much in this story. It's perfect. And it's just two words repeated. And it's perfect. Right moment, right scene. That was beautiful. And the other one that I loved was the internal monologue, the text boxes for Superman, for Clark Kent, when he says, "We must remind them that giants walk the earth," as he's like fucking punching an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
I was like, damn right. That was perfect too.
Oh man. Just to bring up like something kind of random with the writing that I thought was really, really good. That one page story about the woman who was so poor that she couldn't pay the electric bill, but got a $10 tip and used it to buy her son a painting kit. And, you know, she didn't even care she was getting mugs. She just wanted that paint set for her son, and she begged for it. And when they threw her off the train, there was a bomb in her bag, and she died. Oh. I felt like that was amazing, efficient, and beautiful writing. It was so sad. It made me so incredibly sad to read it.
Yeah.
But it was just one page, and it told a story. A complete story.
Yeah, that was fucking brutal. I agree. Yeah. That was great.
I thought that was actually probably the best bit of writing in that comic, though, because it showed that you can do so very, very much in just one page with very few words.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of Superman, right? We hadn't talked about Superman in this at all, other than to mention that he was a tool. So the climax of this story is that Superman-Batman fight. What did you guys think of that scene between those two?
Hella random. Put that out there. I mean, okay, so as always, I have to elaborate. I understand why they were fighting, but I really feel like it was so brutal, and there was so much baggage behind that, especially with Green Arrow coming back to help out.
Oliver, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I hadn't read any of Miller's previous stuff, so it didn't seem like they really needed to have this crazy fight to the death. And I'm sure there was good precedent for it, but it wasn't conveyed here. So instead of feeling like it was a problem with the writing, I actually felt like I needed to do more research.
I don't know if Miller had... I don't know if he did Batman before this. I think it was just... You know, I was reading some critics' reviews of this, and you're not the only one who felt that this was random and extraneous. But to me, I felt like maybe he... It was just another way... It served like two purposes. One, to show you just the kind of man that Batman still is. You know, the whole what's that storyline where Batman's prepared for all the Justice League members? I forget what it's called.
Identity Crisis? Is that when he mind wipes them?
No, it was something else. They kind of redo it in the DC animated movie Justice League Doom.
Oh yeah.
I don't think it's really relevant. Yeah. But and then also it kind of sets the tone for the what comes after. We don't really know what comes after at the end of this story, but it lets Superman know Batman's place, I guess. it's like a shot across the bow kind of thing. Like a maybe I don't know. I kind of agree that it seemed out of place, but it's cool. It's cool as fuck. So
yeah,
I liked it.
I mean, that's one of the age old nerd arguments, right? Who wins in a fight, Batman or Superman? Superman's more powerful, sure, but you know Batman's going to come up with an answer for that. He's going to have a solution somewhere. He will plan around all of that raw strength.
He did. I mean, he brings Superman to his knees physically.
Yes.
But I think the more important thing is that he kind of gets to Superman mentally by making him think initially that he died at his hands. But it's great that Batman's final line about, you know, I want you to remember my hand at your throat. I want you to remember the one man who beat you.
Yeah.
That was just awesome. That last page where Batman's boot that's all got spikes on the bottom instead of tread is kicking Superman in the face. It's just like it's just like this final reminder that this is Batman. This is who Batman is, and this is why you don't fuck with Batman.
Well, and I think it's twofold, right? Batman is the one, of these two, Batman is the one who has to prove himself. He's constantly out there trying to prove that he's right, you know? And in comics, there's the trope that you solve your problems with your fist. Your problems somehow become manifest, your emotional, existential problems become manifest in some kind of monster, you punch it to death, and in so doing, you have conquered that emotional problem within, right? That's just kind of what comics are, in a nutshell. And so, Superman in this represents a problem for Batman. Superman is what they're trying to steer all of the superheroes to be. Cooperate, get in line, or we will come after you. And Superman, believing that the most good can be done from cooperation, did it. He's like, I went out there and I stopped them from invading this island. And I stopped that nuclear bomb. I saved everyone on that island. Right? And even before that, he's out there fighting that fight because he believes in the idea that if he stops this war, he will save the greatest number of lives. And this fight is Batman trying to punch that problem away by showing Superman that he's wrong and that he doesn't save the lives by doing that. You save the lives by maybe inspiring people. And Superman stopped doing that. And that's why this fight wasn't necessary before. Superman inspired people when he was out in front of the eyes of everyone. But now that he's invisible, cooperating, doesn't get on media, doesn't show his face anywhere, and lets the government do that instead, that he's no longer a symbol of inspiration, and he's gone. And Batman has become that symbol of inspiration now as he's training this new generation. That's his plan when they're in this fight. He's like, I am going to die so that I can come back and train Robin how to be better and train the sons of Batman how to be better. And so, like, I think that's why that fight was necessary or what it's supposed to do, but I do agree, it kind of comes out of nowhere. And that it just kind of springs up in issue 4. Hey, cool, fight, go!
Yeah. And I mean, you felt the rivalry, but it didn't seem so strong that this was necessary.
I will say, it was a fun fight to watch, and I think it's a good transition for the art.
Oh, yes.
Because Superman in this looked especially badass all the time, with his, like, black silhouette, red cape, and, like, colored in logo.
Yeah.
That motherfucker was menacing. And when he didn't have the uniform on, right, when he was Clark Kent, oh my god, that scene where he's, like, basically standing there with an eagle on his arm and they're out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Like, oh my
that
god.
That was an amazing one-page spread. The butterflies were around him, too. And he,
yes.
He was sparkly. Oh my god.
And then, of course, what is it, the dog, Bruce ends up hugging the dog, which shows his thing with loyalty and companionship and all that kind of good stuff.
What did you guys think of the Superman absorbing the life from the Earth because he couldn't reach the sun.
I tried to ignore it.
Okay. I understand how it can work, how you can kind of write it off in your head, right? Because, like, he's operated by solar energy, plants are solar energy, plants grow by storing that solar energy, so he can kind of get it from whatever.
So he's, like, photosynthesizing?
Yes. His power comes from photosynthesis.
How come Birdman never did that? I'm just kidding.
Or fucking Animal Man, right? No, because he's, yeah, whatever. Animals and plants aren't the same. I think it was a little corny, but I like that it was a nice circular scene with that scene that's really over the top of him with the butterfly swirling around him. Because that's him there with that Mother Earth embracing him. And when he comes back, she's there for him as well. So, I mean, there's that kind of little circular thing, but at the same time, it was a little like, I don't know, buddy. I don't know about that.
There's also a really great visual parallel with Superman and Batman with those spreads. Just, you know, when we see Superman with the butterflies, like, there's a horse grazing behind him, and he actually looks like freaking Gaston from Beauty and the Beast, the Disney version. Yes.
Oh my god, you're right. I was trying to put my finger on it the whole time I was reading it, and you're right.
But later we see when Batman is like, to the stables, he gets on the horse and like there's I think lightning behind him and he's on a rearing stallion.
Yeah. And,
like, I think it's actually supposed to be a visual parallel showing like this is Superman and what he embodies and this is what Batman embodies and who's cooler. You know it's Batman. But man, those spreads are like so good.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's see. What else? And the coloring in this, too. My God. I love the coloring work in this. I love that it's gray everywhere it needs to be gray. It's washed out when it needs to be washed out. And then when you get that scene with the butterflies flying around Clark Kent, it's still so bright and cheerful, but it's still kind of flat. And the coloring is just so good. It works so well in this, just throughout. I thought it was phenomenal. Especially for a fucking comic book from the 80s. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and there's actually, like, really good shading. Almost like, what are they? Not watercolors, but, like, those pens that kind of look like watercolor. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, but I don't know what they are.
Yeah.
But I know what you're talking about.
Those things.
Yeah.
Those cool things.
Watercolor pens.
It's not just like this cheap printing of, you know, three colors smushed together. It's a carefully shaded and carefully colored comic. And it felt like someone put a lot of time and energy into it, and it really paid off.
Yeah. And, I mean, the coloring is what I bring up, but at the same time, the pencil work underneath it has to be good, too. And I think it's really amazing, especially the face work.
Yeah, Miller's penciling is really freaking good.
Yeah. And, like, the way he can draw that, like, slow grin on people.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's so
creepy.
Good.
Well, Miller has a distinctive art style, and you really see it in, like, in Sin City and 300 also. And I think it works really well. The Batman the Animated Series reminds me of this a little bit. At least the atmosphere you get.
Yeah.
Because it's like everything's against the dark background, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
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 He captures the 80s without being super tacky about it, which is nice. My only penciling gripe was I eventually realized one of those talking head people was Asian. And then I realized the whole time he had just been drawing her eyes as one slanted line each. I was like, oh no, that's worse than Jubilee.
Oh god.
But aside from that, you know, it was good.
Aside from the racism. Well, I actually don't have anything more to say on this comic.
What? You don't?
I don't, do you?
No.
Alright, do you, Jen?
Nope, I'm good.
Alright, let's get down and rate this sumbitch. David, you can go first.
Boom. 4, easy. Loved it. Yeah, like
this. I'm gonna leave that pause in there when I edit this.
No, I really like this comic. It's just a great comic overall, you know? Like, I often say things like, it's a great Batman story. But this is a good comic. And, you know, maybe, you know, people talk about it a lot. Maybe some people think it's overrated, blah, blah, blah. But it's good. I feel like a lot of the Batman stuff that came after it draws on it to a degree. I don't know. Miller's artwork is great. I have trouble, you know, when we rate things, we talk about how, you know, we kind of try to talk about what we liked, and then we kind of talk about what we didn't like to justify the score. But there's not really like a concrete thing that I really didn't like, that I had a real problem with in this comic. It's just good. And, you know, if for some reason you didn't read the comic and you listen to this episode and you don't want to read it still because you're too lazy, watch the DC Animated Universe version of this. It's 2 parts, 2 discs, like 2 DVDs or Blu-rays, I mean. But it's good, and it sticks really close to the story. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really know. Like I said, I'm not really sure what to say about it, but I'm definitely going to go with a 4.
Yeah. All right. How about you, Jen?
Also a 4. Like, this was just a pleasure to read, and for people who... I know some people have a lot of problems with comics and think they're really goofy and nonsensical, and I feel like, you know, yes, this was superhero stuff, and it was over-the-top crazy in terms of how things might actually unfold, but everyone in the comic seemed reasonable to who their character should be, and I feel like Miller did a really good interpretation of Batman. This felt really quintessentially Batman to me, so that made a lot of fun. You know, like David, I actually don't really have anything really bad to say about this, because this comic had faults, but I find those faults to be acceptable. So yeah, a 4.
All right. Well, I'm going to be the spoil sport. I'm going to go to 3.5.
Fucked it up, Andy.
Because I mean, you guys both said there's nothing you can say that you didn't like about this. I hated the narrative style of this. I thought the TV thing was kind of cool for about 4 pages, and I was ready to ditch it. Okay. And I think it slowed the comic down. And like you said, David, turning the page made me go ugh. I also really didn't. We glossed over it when we were having the discussion, but I really didn't like the dismissive treatment of psychiatry. Because I feel like it's one of the great stigmas we have with American healthcare culture, in that people think it's not cool to go to the psychiatrist, that there's something wrong with you, or you're crazy like Joker, or whatever, or they're just going to tell you that you're sexually repressed, which is the exact bullshit excuse they give in here. And that just always kind of chafes me, because that's a problem we have with our culture that we need to fix, and this kind of thing only perpetuates it. But it's also from fucking 1986. All of that said, fuck, man. That scene with Robin, and he's holding her, and he says, good soldier, fuck, that broke my heart, and everything built on that in their relationship, and who Batman is, and why he ended the comic and ended the storyline, this part of his life, the way that he chose to end it, ties so beautifully around to that scene, and fucking Superman punching a goddamn aircraft carrier in half and saying, gods walk the earth, like, fuck. That's great line, good combination art, man, yes. So as much as I have gripes with this, it is still a really good comic, and there's still so much good stuff that comes out of this that it's still worth a 3.5 to me, even with all the gripes and difficulty I had finishing reading it. It was a good, worthwhile comic. Speaking of worthwhile comics, next week we're going to read the second of our Miller part of our Morrison versus Miller arc. We're going to read The Dark Knight Strikes Again by Frank Miller. It's from 2001-2002. It's a 3-issue miniseries. You can get that bad boy on Amazon. There's a little link on our website, which is www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. On the right, you click on Future Selves. There's a little button underneath the picture of the comic. It says Amazon. Click on that. Sends you right to where you need to buy it. It'll tell you stuff we read in the future. You can hit past shows. It'll show you fucking way back to episode one. 140 episodes
before this. Oh, my God.
140. I fucking love that number. Yeah. Just fucking listen to all of them. You know, it's 4th of July is tomorrow. You might have a 4-day weekend. Just listen to all 140. It'll be fun. Maybe.
Marathon.
Yeah. That'd be so weird if somebody marathoned us. If you do decide to marathon us and listen to all 140 episodes, send us an email and let us know what you think at
AtomicPoweredSupercast@gmail.com.
Or you could just, like, clip out a link to your favorite episode and then go to Facebook.com/APSupercast or Twitter.com/APSupercast and let us know about it. Just post a little thing like, oh my god, this blah 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 episode about Dark Phoenix was my favorite of all time, which would be terrible because it means that we've only gotten worse since our first episode. But that's okay. I could live with that. At least you send the link. Also, apsupercast.tumblr.com. I think I have 4 posts there now. 4. Damn!
If you gave me permissions to log in, I would post things
as well. Oh yeah, I need to do that. I'll do that in a little bit.
Yeah, do
maybe
it.
Maybe sometime this week. Okay. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
Yes. All right. Until next week, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Have a happy 4th of July.